Welcome to Private Equity Perspectives, a podcast by BDO USA's private equity practice. Each episode, BDO connects with leaders in the private equity space to discuss the latest trends driving deal activity, fund strategies, and portfolio company optimization.
Hello, and welcome to BDO's Private Equity Perspectives podcast, where we explore the trends impacting private equity today. I'm Todd Kinney, National Relationship Director in BDO's private equity practice. Excited to have two guests joining me today. The first, Engin Okaya. Engin is a Executive Managing Director at Prudential Private Capital. And next, Brett Hickey, who is the founder and CEO of Star Mountain Capital. Today, we'll be talking about everything from deal trends to emerging technologies, and we'll wrap with focus on talent management. Now, just a quick reminder to our listeners that the remarks and opinions of our guests do not necessarily represent BDO's views. So with all that out of the way, Engin, again, welcome to the podcast. You joined Prudential Private Capital in 1998, and now as Executive Managing Director, you oversee private placement and mezzanine activity across several regions. Maybe you can share a bit about yourself and your firm.
Sure. And thank you, Tom, for having me today. Looking forward to our discussion. As you said, I've been at Prudential Private Capital, or what I'll refer to as PPC, for 25 years in a variety of different roles. We pursue a direct origination model. So over my career, I've sourced and underwritten and managed a portfolio of private debt assets. We're generalists, so a little bit of everything, a pie slice of the American economy, as I call it. And we also invest across the risk spectrum in mezzanine, direct lending, and then fixed rate, investment grade, and below investment grade debt securities. So in my current role, I oversee four of our offices and sit on our mezzanine investment committee. So can speak to trends that I'm seeing across those four offices when we get into it. But again, thanks for having me.
All right. Glad you could be here. Again, Brett, thank you for joining us as founder and CEO of Star Mountain Capital. Can you share a bit about yourself, your firm, and your strategies?
Thanks, Todd. Always a pleasure.
Yeah.
Star Mountain Capital is a lower middle market private investment specialist. We do private lending, private equity, and secondary fund investing. 100% firm-owned and team-owned company with $4 billion in assets under management, and one of the largest teams that is exclusively focused on investing in the U.S. lower middle market with approximately 90 full-time people and 40 operating partners.
So for our listeners, I guess I'd like to set the stage for a conversation in terms of how you see the landscape changing as we've embarked on a new year. I mean, I think most agree 2023 was certainly a challenging year for exits. Accordingly, we saw many firms and certainly a lot of our clients turn their focus to value creation and portco optimization. So I'll ask both of you, and Engin, maybe we'll start with you. How have your acquisition and value creation strategies evolved in the last year, I guess, if at all?
Yeah, no, Todd, you're absolutely correct. We didn't see as many exits in our portfolio last year. We also, depending on the point in the year, also saw companies still struggling with supply chain challenges, trying to optimize labor, less visible demand, and just changing customer purchasing habits. So it was definitely a challenging year. I'd say, you know, in some situations, this led to lower margins, which then compounded with rising debt costs, certainly created challenges. So I'd say, as you indicated, a lot of companies spent the year a little inward looking. We spent a lot of time on KPI dashboard creations, talking about upgrading talent and or optimizing talent. We spent some time in certain more labor-intensive organizations thought about new jurisdictions or where we could potentially outsource labor, maybe lower costs in different areas of the country or internationally. just as a way to try and preserve margin and cash flow. And then we also looked at a number of smaller tuck-in acquisitions. So again, playing to the multiple arbitrage opportunity. You didn't want to exit, but you were still trying to grow the business in an increasingly competitive and challenging market. So it was, it seemed to be a good strategy at the time. The future will tell, to try and find some smaller tuck-in opportunities. So we saw a number of those over the course of the year, last year as well.
Yeah, we, lots of our clients were doing those add-ons, but we're starting to see more platform requests, which is good. So Brett, how about your approach to deal acquisition and value creation?
Very similar. We focused on the add-on acquisitions, particularly looking to capitalize on acquiring businesses for our portfolio companies from other businesses that are owned by aging demographic business owners that in many cases are more motivated sellers and interested in potentially working less and rolling some equity into deals as well to stay aligned with team and customers. So that was quite successful from a portfolio management perspective. Taking a pretty long-term view on our business, we took the opportunity to invest inward. For example, we further invested in our portfolio valuation maximization roadmap that we have internally, developing different tools and partnerships to help our portfolio companies, as Engin said, to cut costs, to find new customers, to expand internationally and so forth. And so we invested further into some of those tools. And then also took the time internally to make some additional technology investments that are always on the to-do list. And limping forward sometimes, we took an opportunity to push forward, you know, faster and harder with respect to how we can help our portfolio companies have better data and information for their own investment and management decisions, and then have that flow into our portfolio for us to build better portfolios and provide the type of transparency and look-through information that a lot of our investors find helpful as well. So those were some of the additional kind of within Star Mountain things and within our portfolio companies that we worked on last year. And then on top of that, I would add some of the challenges that came. We invest a lot in businesses that are often essential service-oriented companies in the United States, which are often quite durable and recession resilient. COVID threw a bit of a spike into that. And so there were companies that we had invested in that got hit by COVID that we had to really work hard with the management teams and executives to help build and protect capital. And thankfully, but it ended up actually being quite a successful year for some good exits. I think that felt good for our team because as you all know, working through challenges is really easy on paper. But it's often a lot more difficult and involves making a lot of hard decisions.
Yeah. Well, it's, I believe it or not, Brett, I don't hear the big COVID word as much as we used to in past episodes. So I'm glad it's sparingly at this point. But so I'll say we've seen market conditions improve along with rising cash flows and valuations. We could, certainly potentially see a increase in deal activity. So, Engin, these trends continue. What deal drivers do you anticipate we'll see?
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right, Todd. I think with some of the cost cuts implemented that I mentioned earlier, slightly more stable demand drivers, and then just a little bit more stable of an operating environment, I do think we're going to see more companies coming to market. I mean, the political climate and the election this year may throw that into a little bit of a tizzy toward the end of the year. But I'd say in the next, 4, 5, 6 months, at least the trends that I'm hearing are certainly that more companies will be coming to market. I also think on the buyer side that either private equity funds or strategic buyers have gotten a little bit more comfortable with the cost of debt. And the cost has come down given the lack of deals last year, too. So direct lending funds, including ourselves, are itching to put money out the door, which has driven down the cost of capital and spreads in certain industries. So I think net net, it means that there will be more deal activity this year. And I think it will allow companies to operate in a slightly more friendly environment as well, which hopefully bodes well for the economy and overall M&A activity.
Yeah. Brett, do you have similar expectations?
Yeah, I agree. As Engin mentioned, I believe people are starting to find a little more confidence in the views of a soft type of landing, and therefore more confidence to transact. When the world is uncertain, often people pause and freeze unless they have to transact. And right now, I think one of the other benefits for portfolios that are in the United States, well, the United States is far from perfect and has its own challenges. On a relative global basis, I think most people view the U.S. economy as still being probably the strongest from entrepreneurship, governance, law, the ability to transact and grow. Some of the challenges that Europe is facing, in other areas in the world, and those uncertainties, I think drives incremental demand for investors into the U.S., which is generally positive. And I think both for Engin and our strategies at Star Mountain as well, some of the benefits for us are that keeps the larger markets efficient. Obviously, if you look at the U.S. public markets, they continue to go through all-time highs. And that trickles its way down into private company valuations. So the efficiency and the demand for investing in the U.S. is positive if you can do more labor-intensive and resource-intensive, smaller, growing transactions, which, of course, Todd, your team facilitates a lot of. I think one can create a lot of value building companies larger into higher valuation, more efficient markets. So I think we'll continue to see that. I think there's two different currents happening as our supply-demand economics right now. If we think over the last probably 5 years, one of the things that we benefit from is the insights into the businesses through our secondaries business, where we have close to 1,000 additional private businesses that we're tracking. And the dynamics in the lower middle market are that the smaller banks have been challenged to attract and retain deposits and are therefore, in many cases, liquidity challenged, whereas the larger banks have been the beneficiaries of those deposits and have capital. And given where interest rates are today, the banks need to put that capital to work. So you have larger banks having capital, wanting to put it to work. You have smaller banks generally not having capital and therefore challenged to deploy. And similar for larger asset managers, when COVID hit, smaller asset management firms that didn't have large fundraising teams really struggled to raise capital. And that really hasn't changed. And so the inflows of capital have gone materially into the larger market. And therefore, as a result of that, the supply-demand dynamics are almost actually inverted right now in America between larger markets and smaller markets. Nothing, of course, is exactly perfect, but we definitely notice very different types of drivers for both demands of capital and supply of capital. I think that creates different both threats and opportunities.
All right. Appreciate both the insights there. A lot of good takeaways for our listeners. So I teased the technology topic in my opening remarks, but Brett, I'm going to start with you on this one. So I know your shop is focused on technological innovation. Is your firm exploring any emerging technologies this year? And if so, do you have any examples to share?
Yeah, we constantly are, Todd. We actually have a little bit of a, almost, I guess you call it, an R&D division internally, where we are looking at technologies, evaluating technologies. And there are so many technologies within the investment world being built right now It's always fun to keep in touch with friends of mine in the fintech space to see what are they investing in, where do they see new advancements, and to learn from that. And we'll often follow businesses, not too dissimilar to how we invest, follow businesses for a couple of years to see if they do in fact build a strong enough business to execute against what they want to do. Because when you're going to implement a technology, at least what we have found, but it tends to take a lot more time and a lot more money than you hope it will. And so if you're going to spend that time and money to implement a new technology, you really want to make sure it's with a partner that's going to be durable, that's going to be lasting, that's going to be able to continue to innovate. And so we actually spend a lot of time underwriting and evaluating technologies. And it's a pretty broad range that we've implemented and continue to. And it starts with customer service, in a sense. We have different fund products for the high net worth investing space, as well as institutional investors, and a whole bunch of different ways to try to help, you know, optimize different desires, you know, whether it's subscription structures, how investors can come into funds, reporting to investors, all the way into, we talked a little bit earlier on this session here, Tawn, about underlying technologies for your portfolio and how you can get better data and better information if you can really start to integrate portfolio companies into clear systems to get faster data, better data. And the way we've approached that is by partnering with our portfolio companies to share that data with them, because, you know, the reality is we need them to work with us. And so they have to be motivated to help us get the data, get it fast, get it accurate, so that it can be of value to us and our investors. And therefore, we try to bring that data to them. There's actually quite a few different things that we've been implementing and are implementing. Even the internal management things, I'll share one thing, Airtable, as one perhaps that might be applicable to a large group of your audience, that allows, you know, database workflow management. And we use that to operate almost every single vertical or business, for example.
Wow. Well, I could tell you for sure, Brett, we've had many guests on the podcast, and you're the first to talk about a R&D divisions. We'll table that for now, but I appreciate all that insight. So, Engin, how about PPC? How are your portfolio companies leveraging emerging technologies? Is there excitement or perhaps apprehension? And, you know, how are you helping to support innovation at your companies?
Yeah, I mean, Todd, I think the big word or abbreviation of the day is AI, right? So everybody's talking about AI, ChatGPT. I think, you know, 6 months ago, people thought it was going to dramatically change the way everybody does everything in their life. But I, as excited as people are about the idea and the concept, I think they're equally cautious and apprehensive once people really understand how it works and how your information can get in the public domain. So we've been kind of monitoring and, you know, collaborating on the use of AI in portfolio companies. I mean, it seems to me like most companies are using it almost exclusively internally, with really no external facing AI implementation, just given the risks and the challenges and the unknown. So I've seen it implemented, you know, very well, especially in HR functions, for example. So being able to query large amounts of data, or be able to summarize large amounts of data, or using AI to help write job descriptions has been another one. Or, you know, translating emails into other languages that used to be done a little bit less eloquently and maybe a little bit more crude. So I think this is going to be a discussion point and a avenue that people are going to have to understand and explore for, you know, the next 10, 15, if not 20 years. But I do think it's the one hot topic that people are trying to figure out how to harness. The power of it is just exponential. So we're looking at what we can do internally from a portfolio analytics perspective, as well, just to be able to harness the technology, but I'd say, you know, equal excitement and apprehension, just trying to understand how to best use the technology, but also make sure that you're protecting yourself and your proprietary information at the same point in time.
Our coffee break segment will be coming up next. And one of my colleagues from our BDO Digital group, they are living and breathing AI, and it's really amazing. I've seen all the different things they're doing for private equity funds and their portcos. But again, that's my colleague. We'll go into that during the coffee break. So Brett, before we leave the topic, what are you looking for when assessing or evaluating a potential investment targets? Technological capabilities and innovation strategies?
With respect to portfolio companies, Todd, that we're investing in?
Yes, yes.
I think where we first ask ourselves some pretty simple questions, including, does this business need to exist? Who is it bringing distinctive value to? What are other ways that an end customer could get that value? Really try to understand the value proposition. We take, you know, private equity style approach to underwriting with the view that if it's a good end industry, a good business model, and, you know, then we dive into management, customers, operations, balance sheeting. We actually start more with fundamentals of the business first, because, you know, we're all investing into the future of a business, not the past. We, of course, all love to run our spreadsheets and look at the past and historical trends and whatnot. And I don't know that I've ever seen a business plan that is shrinking. They're always up and growing. And ultimately, that's really where we start. And we also like businesses where people are taking a probability managed approach to running their business. So if you're driving sales, where are you driving them? How are you driving them? How are you trying to manage things? Some of the mistakes you see businesses do is way over hire. You know, perhaps they can under hire, miss opportunities, and that balance is never perfect. But if people are taking an approach that has some variance to it, I think that's a good way to operate. And so we probably are a little bit bent towards management teams that kind of think in a probability weighted way of operating. And that's really how we like investing ultimately. So that is kind of a flowing up and a flowing down way of looking at a business. And then specifically within the businesses, Todd, you know, one area that we're very focused on is the customers and the customers of our customers. Engin made a great point earlier around supply chain challenges and concerns. And we all, as we look at businesses, even though we're investing in US and Canadian based businesses, if you look at Europe and other economies and recessions and how quickly China's slowing, and, you know, declining population and things of that nature. And you look at who are your customers and who's the customer of your customer to try to think about what that could do to future revenues. At the end of the day, we have found you can work through challenges, you can work through cost, you know, reconciliation, fixing, tweaking. But if you lose revenues, I've yet to figure out how to solve that problem, generally speaking. And so we put a lot of emphasis around the revenue stability ultimately.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to hit a brief pause on the conversation with Engin and Brett and turn it over to our coffee break guest, who's my BDO Digital colleague, Kirsty Tiernan. She is the go-to resource in the firm for AI and all technology, you know, expertise. So I know you'll enjoy the coffee break. Take it away, Kirsty.
Hi, my name is Kirsty Tiernan, and I am the digital go-to-market leader at BDO Digital. We at BDO have the unique opportunity to collaborate very closely with a lot of our private equity clients, helping them navigate AI. Our focus is on leveraging the power of AI to not only streamline processes and increase productivity, but also to enhance decision-making and therefore driving better investment outcomes. Together, we help explore innovative AI solutions. We help tailor and customize those to each client, and then that helps ensure that our clients are staying ahead of the competitive private equity landscape. Private equity has been one of the areas that's been most interested in generative AI and how to use it to gain productivity and efficiency, along with really focusing on the competitive advantage that it can create. So for example, SIM summarization has been a prime example. In this world of private equity and how fast-paced everything moves, efficiency is everything. So AI tools are being used to digest, to summarize these extensive SIM documents, and that allows decision makers to be able to grasp the essentials of the investments in a quick way. So it's not only saves time, but it also enhances the decision-making process. Another area where AI is making a significant impact is around financial modeling and forecasting. And by using AI, we're able to provide predictions and insights based on lots of different data sets that would be impossible to analyze manually in a reasonable time frame. So that capability is transforming how firms approach investment decisions, how they approach risk management, and even strategic planning. One of the most compelling use cases we've seen involves contract redlining. And traditionally, that's been a very labor-intensive process. And with AI, now we're able to automate a lot of it. So AI can quickly identify key clauses, they suggest amendments, flag potential issues, significantly speed up the negotiations and reducing the risk of error. So that application of AI is just not just about efficiency, but it's about securing better, more favorable, optimized contracts. So for PE professionals looking to incorporate AI, where's the best place to start? It can be very overwhelming, but we typically refer to a very clear, actionable roadmap to make that a smooth transition. And that's our five steps to AI. And the first of those five steps is education. And getting your team to understand AI, that's the first step. It's about getting comfortable with what AI can do for your business. AI is everywhere. And understanding that potential is the key to staying ahead. Secondly, use cases. Identifying how AI can specifically benefit your firm. It's not about chasing the latest AI trend. It's about finding applications that will genuinely drive return and offer a solid ROI. And then prepare and build. That step three is about adopting a cloud-first environment, making sure that you have a secure environment, making sure you've thought through your data platform and your data privacy issues, any regulations that might concern you, and all the risks that might come along with this, making sure that you have that solid foundation before moving forward. Step four is all about enablement and adoption. And overcoming the fear of AI is essential. It's important for everyone to understand that AI is here to augment our capabilities, not replace us, and that the real danger lies in being outpaced by those who embrace AI. So this change management step is all about getting people more comfortable and understanding how it's going to affect them. And then go and grow. You don't want to wait on the sidelines. AI is advancing every day, and waiting means falling behind. So start small. Learn from their failures and scale your AI initiatives. It's about continuous improvement and growth. And I think those five steps, it's not just about adopting AI, but it's about fundamentally transforming how private equity firms operate, how you make decisions, how you secure your future. And with AI, you know, you're going to be able to navigate that journey and leverage AI to unlock those new levels of productivity.
As we've seen, the potential for AI to just truly transform the private equity sector is remarkable. We've got all these different use cases that can increase productivity and efficiency and create an overall strategic advantage. And so if you're ready to take the next step in your AI journey, BDO Digital is here to guide you. We have a simple five-step process to getting started with AI. And that starts with education, exploring use cases, preparing and building a good foundation, enablement and adoption, and then go and grow and helping you iterate on your AI strategy and strategic approach.
All right. Thanks so much, Kirsty. Let's pivot back to our conversation with Engin and Brett with a focus on talent challenges impacting private equity. So as we know, talent challenges continue to be a top concern for fund managers across sectors. So I'm going to ask both of you, but Brett, let's start with you. Has talent management been a priority focus for your firm and Portcos?
It always is. Ultimately, my belief is that we're all highly in the talent and people management business from that perspective. you know, finding great people, motivating them, retaining them, helping them keep focused, which I'll dive down into a little bit more. And then how does everybody fit together and how does that all grow where we have an evolving economy, evolving businesses, threats and opportunities always shifting around a little bit, making sure that there's enough clarity in what people are doing, but also enough flexibility to still capitalize on, you know, opportunities and how the team, you know, works together as a bit of a speedboat versus a tanker, if you will. And I think the one area of a drill down is helping keep people focused. One of the things that we do in being fortunate to be 100% employee owned is align interest by sharing the equity profits with 100% of our team, because work from home is a different dynamic. And I think we all probably have at least some of that with our teams at bare minimum. And, you know, you've got to be able to further trust and rely on people. Nobody wants to be micromanaged and nobody wants to be micromanaging. And so you need to trust people, especially in this dynamic. And so I think aligning interests helps motivate the behavior that we all want. And I think that's important. And we continue to see a lot of people focused on that and trying to solve that Rubik's Cube a little bit. I think the second aspect is, what are both the challenges and opportunities of the aging demographic that we have? One observation I would say is there's a lot of people interested in working much longer than the way I think we were all growing up to think. So, you know, we have a number of people on our team, for example, that are in their 60s that are very driven, passionate, focused, and that's a different dynamic when you know, normally we'd probably be thinking of, okay, they may want to retire really soon or something like that. You know, I think that's something that is evolving, given that, you know, we've really never had, finding us alive, this big of a percentage of the population being at this age. And, you know, again, I think there's both threats and opportunities there for people that, you know, keep an open mind to say, not everybody's the same. Some people want different things at different ages. Then there's probably lastly the dynamic of, you know, the younger generation that's now starting to see some challenges. But, you know, we came out of an economy that if you graduated college 2010 or later, you pretty much only saw everything up and to the right. Even though COVID technically had economic challenges, there was so much stimulus that jobs continue to generally grow. And when we think about businesses and we ask ourselves, which I'm sure, you know, Engin does with her team, can this business pass along its cost increase to its customers? Unless Engin has observed something different than I have, we as asset managers are not increasing our management fees and passing costs along to our investors. And so we all have to think about how to be running and operating our businesses. And ultimately what we find with our younger talent is having a large focus on having them in the right roles to make sure that they're growing, helping them add more value so that we can justify compensating them more and really building that. And it's required us to be pretty dynamic and focused on how to make sure we're continuing to help them grow so that they can get what they want and it financially makes sense for us as a business.
So Engin, Brad is teeing you up here, but so tell us a bit about how you're working with your Portco business leaders to really attract, retain, and ensure the right talent is in place to execute the, you know, in general, the value creation plan.
Sure. I mean, I think the tool that we've found to be most helpful is the Management Stock Option Plan or MSOP plan. And so I spend a lot of time focused on, you know, the amount of the plan, how it vests, how it's allocated between different C-suite members, et cetera. But based on, you know, 2022 and 2023 performance, there were instances where we had to rethink the plan and recut the plan with management teams to make sure that they were still incented. I don't think people can jump around from job to job these days as they could a couple years ago. But we still do really want to retain talent once we feel like we have the right talent pool. So in a lot of these portfolio companies, the management stock option plan is what really incents the C-suite executives. And so we've had to get creative with those. Sometimes we've had to bring down some of the hurdle rates in certain situations. We've had to think about, you know, putting other securities into the capital stack to make sure that the management team is cut in at the right levels and in the right amount. So it's a little bit more out of science, given that every situation and every company is different and everyone's personal financial situation is different as well. But I do find that the MSOP is one of the strongest tools that we can use to attract and retain and ensure that the right talent is in place to execute the value creation plan.
Yeah. All right, Angie. Well, I appreciate that. Believe it or not, this brings us to our last topic, and that's your outlook for the next 12 months. It's certainly no secret that 2023 was challenging of a year for many of us. I am, however, feeling optimistic for the year ahead, as I said earlier. So what trends are you monitoring for private equity in 2024? I guess, Brett, we'll start with you again and then let Angen wrap us up.
By the way, I'd like to add just one thing on what she said earlier. And I think that that's such an important part of the amount of experience that Angen obviously has in this industry and similar to RT, is that you can't just design a program and throw it out and implement it. Everyone, as she referenced, is really different and a bit of an art that way, because you have to understand the people, their needs, their desires, and their dynamics to really figure out what you're going to create, what you're going to solve for that's going to drive the needed motivation. So I just wanted to highlight that point that she made. One of the things that I'll try to add something that might be a little bit provocative and perhaps insightful, which is we have had now about 18 months of high interest rates. What has that done almost definitively? Well, one of the things it has done is it's reduced the amount of cash flows that most businesses have, and therefore those cash flows have resulted in probably less R&D, which we talked about, have Star Mountain's done a lot of R&D investing, but I think a lot of businesses have not had that. There's a lag effect to that. So what will the future consequences be of businesses that are reducing growth in products, technology, sales teams, things that take, you know, 1 to 2 or 3 years to actually drive future value? We're starting to get closer to where we may see the impacts of that. And I would query whether that has a potential systematic slowdown effect in revenue and earnings of businesses in general. And I think ultimately there are unfortunately a lot of tailwinds and a lot of headwinds, and how will they play out? I don't know, obviously, but I do think that we have quite a bit of political uncertainty, geopolitical risks, and a lot of parts of the global economy slowly and or already in a recession, and a lot of parts of the economy are also having aging demographics, which GDP is typically a function of productivity times your workforce. And I did mention earlier that the workforce, many people are actually working a lot longer. And so I don't envision any cliff, but I would think overall the economy will continue to slow a little bit. And I think you've got tail risks of things having a little bit bigger of a hit. For example, if some of the commercial real estate challenges do start to ripple through the economy further and people lose confidence, people are generally in fear or greed mode. If it switches into fear mode, and then you start to see the stock market drop, and then you have people have margin calls, less wealthy, feel less wealthy, pull back on their spending. There are many scenarios that things could get a lot more challenging, but I think that's in lower probability.
Yeah. So, Angen, what trends are you monitoring for PE in 2024?
I mean, I think the biggest driver of anything is just going to be a cost of capital. And Brett laid out some of the knock-on effects of what we see as a result. Maybe I'll take a little bit more optimistic view than Brett and just say, I think it's all based on a comparison point, right? So if you look at peak debt, peak underlying treasury rates, interest rates of, 18 months ago, I do think, as I said earlier, that companies, private equity funds, individuals even feel a little bit better about the cost of capital right now and are spending a little bit more frequently. I mean, the challenge ends up being, the dollars that are coming into the consumer's wallet. So we are seeing changing consumer habits, which may put all this a little bit in risk. But I don't think that the underlying cost of the financing or debt is going to be as big of a driver. But I do think it's a very large factor in terms of individuals and companies making decisions that they do. So that's probably the number one aspect. Number two, I'd say, is inflation. We obviously watch inflation data to see where that's trending and look at the correlation, obviously, between cost of capital and inflation as well. And then, as Brett alluded to as well, I mean, I think just the fallout of what happens on the commercial real estate side is going to be a little bit of an unknown, but the debt wall that's coming up in the commercial real estate market, especially within office, is just huge. So that's going to take, 2-3 years probably to make its way through the system. So between the cost of capital, inflation, and kind of just the general real estate market, putting aside the political environment, those are probably the areas that we're monitoring the closest.
So, listen, thanks to both of you for a really interesting conversation. You treaded the fine line of not sharing secret sauce, but giving our listeners a lot of good insight and just thoughts on how you go about things. So that's always appreciated. BDO values the relationship with both of your firms. I know how busy you are. And I appreciate you joining us today. So thank you from all of BDO.
Thanks, Todd. Have a great day.
To our listeners, thanks so much for listening. If you haven't already, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and leave a review of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, this has been BDO's Private Equity Perspectives.
The views presented by our guests do not necessarily reflect the views of their respective firms.